For the Peterson Automotive Museum, this is Car Stories. My name is AJ. Today I am joined with racing legend Parnelli Jones. Parnelli Jones is a part of a documentary his family made called Godspeed, The Story of Paige Jones. It's an incredible, touching, and moving documentary about his son, Paige. You could check it out at GodspeedPJ.com. The movie is Godspeed, The Story of Paige Jones. Mr. Parnelli Jones, thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you.
Before we get into the documentary and your long career and your family, let's start back to the very beginning with you. What is your earliest automotive memory?
Probably when I was born, I guess. I came home in the car. I don't know. I was into horses when I turned 16 years old. I had sold my horse and bought a hot rod, and it was kind of a radical car and needed a lot of maintenance, so to speak. And I had a mechanic that was a friend of mine, and I used to wash parts in after school, and he'd work on my car.
And what made you want to get that hot rod? Was it the idea is you wanted to eventually go racing?
Well, I was fascinated by the 23 bucket T, and that's what it was, because I had saw in a race at Ascot, Old Carroll Speedway, actually. And Troy Ruttman was the driver, and he's driving one of these 23 T bucket hot rods, and he started in the back and won the race, and so it created a fondness for that kind of car.
And how soon after you got that hot rod did you start to go racing?
Well, quite a while later, because of course I was only 17 when I ran my first race, and that was at the same basic track, and they had an old B course. And my cousin had made a old jalopy, and because I was working in the shop on my own car, he thought I ought to help him. And so that gave me an opportunity to warm up the car and stuff like that. That kind of opened the door, so to speak.
Did you realize right away, were you good at it? Did you pick it up naturally, or was it something you really had to learn how to do?
Well, I was fascinated with it, but I really had to learn. After wrecking my car week after week, I blew the engine up and didn't have enough money to fix it. And a guy told me he'd build an engine for my car if I'd just slow down and quit trying to win the race in the first corner, and then finally something clicked. I had all this desire, no talent. So I was learning on the way up, and again, like I said, crashed my car a lot.
What were some of the races and some of the things you were doing on the way up? How do you get from, you know, being a driving around in a race in an old jalopy and blowing engines to the Indy 500?
Well, it doesn't come easy. I mean, obviously, I climbed the ladder. Once I realized that I had some talent. Well, actually, I didn't have any talent, but I'd earned my way, so to speak, and was able to keep my car out of trouble. I started winning races, and so you win enough races, you get invited into different divisions of racing. And I climbed that ladder, so to speak, to midget sprint cars.
And what age do you think it kind of clicked for you of, I'm not going to be a lawyer. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a race car driver.
Well, I was fascinated by the amount of money that I could make, and it was nothing hardly. But I was taking $40, $50 a week home and racing two or three nights a week. And I was putting the money in the bank, and of course I was living at home, and I thought, that was really something. Thought if I could ever just make $10,000, I'd be rich forever.
Well, hopefully you've made at least $10,000 in your racing career since then. What was your first big race? What was the, you know, because it had to have been before the Indy 500. What was the first race where you went, wow, this is the big time?
Well, actually, I had a lot of great wins in the jalopies, and we used to run every Sunday at Gardena Stadium, and that propelled me. A lot of people got a lot of recognition because they, even though they might have a sprint car or stock car or something, they could see me run on Sunday, and that's probably why I got invited quickly into other divisions. But I went into some modifieds, won the first race I was in, and went into midgets and finished second in the championship the first year, and went into sprint cars and style 8 model stock cars. Actually came out of NASCAR before I went into IndyCar racing. So I won a lot of West Coast stock car races.
Was there ever a favorite type of car, favorite type of race? Did you like sort of the full body of driving a stock car? Did you prefer sort of the agility of an open wheel car?
Well, you just realized that open wheel cars were a lot more dangerous than the stock cars.
Yeah.
So, you know, you certainly have more respect. You know, you can bend the fenders on a stock car, but you can't play that same game in a sprint car.
Was the danger ever a worry for you?
Well, yeah, you always have it in the back of your mind. You have to have respect, and I think that's, you know, I was very fortunate not to have any, you know, spending any nights in the hospital. My whole career, I never spent a night in the hospital. But so that was really, really something. I mean, that's had a lot of luck in that, too.
Do you think it's more luck, though, or do you think it's more you? I mean, do you think it was more, like you said, your respect for the car and the people around you?
Well, I think it's both.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have fortune. You know, you have to be fortunate to not stay out of trouble. And not that I didn't get in trouble and had a fracture now and then. It's just that I was fortunate not to get hurt.
Mm-hmm. And when you hit the big time, when you're at Indy and you're at the Indy 500 for the first time, what feeling is that like for a young Parnelli Jones?
Well, I was pretty well established by the time I got an invitation there. I could have went to Indianapolis 2 or 3 years before I did. But I wanted, when I finally decided to go to Indy, I wanted to make sure I had a car that I could be competitive with. And I probably waited maybe a year or so. I should have maybe went sooner, because when I got there, I found out these guys put their pants on just like I do.
Yeah.
So they were, you know, and in fact, I went out and practiced, and Jim Rathman had won the year before, and I passed him coming off the corner, and I didn't know him that well, and he came over to me afterwards at my garage, and he says, "How'd you do that, kid?" You know, so that gave me a lot of confidence in that I was capable of doing it. My rookie year, I said, you know, I led the race for 27 laps, was going away, and I got lost a cylinder in the engine.
Is the track as tough as people say it is? Because, you know, it's such an iconic, you know, four-turn oval shape. But it's very flat. And people go, you don't realize just how hard you're pulling in those turns.
Well, actually, all three, four corners are different.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things. Turn one's the roughest corner. And I'd say probably four, between one and four, are probably the roughest corners. But you just have to be able to learn to negotiate them to the best you can, you know. But it's downhill, and seems like in the front straightaway, and uphill down the back straightaway. So, you know, it makes a little bit of difference. It's just feels like in the banking.
And what was it like what I find so fascinating, and I think I'm looking at a picture of it right behind you, is your turbine car. You drove it in.
Yeah.
How did the idea of you racing this very experimental car come about?
Well, I'd already, you know, fortunately had won, and I should have won two or three times more. But anyway, Andy Granatelli, he wanted me to take when I was doing tire tests, he wanted me to take a ride in the Novi, which I did, and ran faster than anybody had ever ran in it. And from that time on, he was hounding me week after week to drive for him. Of course, I wouldn't drive the Novi because it wasn't very reliable. Excuse me. Anyway, so when he started to do the turbine, he had it just about finished, and he invited me to come over and see it. And when I did, I saw, you know, something that was probably not going to work very well.
But it did. It did. Well, it was a great car up until the last lap.
Yeah, what happened was, so I said, well, I'm going to test my car over at Phoenix, bring it over there. I'll take a ride in it. So the more I drove it, the more I got interested in it and everything else. So now when I left there, I had very mixed emotions about whether I wanted to drive it or not, because, you know, I just didn't know if it was that going to be that good as it was. Anyway, I figured it was a financial thing, so I made a financial deal out of it. Asking Andy for a lot of money to drive it, and he paid me. So I knew then that I'd go back. I figured I could make the race with it, see how good it was. And actually, it wasn't very good in qualifying, because in the 7 years that I drove there, I started sixth, second row outside, and that was my worst starting spot. And everybody thought I was sandbagging, but the reason they did is the thing had a lot of torque. It would run real hard coming out of the corners across the short straightaways and out onto the long straightaways, but about halfway down, it would quit accelerating. So the guys, when they were out practicing, running real light loads of fuel and 10 or 15% nitro in their fuel, like Mario and Foyt and Andretti. So anyway, I knew race day when they put on 75 gallons of fuel, how much we were carrying, and took that 10 or 15% nitro so they get fuel mileage, that they probably wouldn't have enough to get by me. Basically, that's what happened. But they accused me of sandbagging because I was so dominant in the race. Because when that happened there, I mean, I just could consistently run almost as fast as I qualified.
Who were some of the people you loved to race with back then? Who were some of your favorites to be on the track during that time?
Well, most of my careers were, of course, against AJ and Foyt and Sachs and Branson and Herdebees and a lot of other, you know, good Ray Roger McCluskey. And we had a lot of good race drivers back then, and then dangerous sport. But I ran midgets, sprint cars, stock cars, sports cars, Indy cars, all at the same time.
And that's what I think I find fascinating. And maybe it's because, you know, Mario Andretti did a lot of that too, did a little bit of everything. And maybe it was racers of your era. You guys could just sit in anything. You know, you don't see an F1 driver really go to Baja or go to a NASCAR driver. You know, sometimes they'll go to Indy, but racers aren't as diverse as they were back then. Were you just sort of strap me in, I'll go, it doesn't matter what direction or if it's dirt or cement?
Well, I'm the kind of guy that likes to see what's on the other side of the hill anyway.
So yeah.
That probably played a part in it. But, you know, it's just, big races were the IndyCar races, you know, and they always seemed to land on Sunday. And then we had a lot of races on Saturday night and Friday night during the week. They have midget races and stuff like that. So there was a period there for a while that I did about 65 races a year.
And what about the off-roading? Because even if you never would have won Indy, you would have had just as large a name of yourself doing Baja and running an off-roading. So what led you down that dirt path?
Well, I couldn't stay on any longer. Yeah. So, no, actually, I was heckled into it by... I drove stock cars and won a championship for Bill Straup in a Ford Mercury, actually. And because I was driving for him, he says, why don't you come and do the Baja or the Mint 400 at that time? And I said, well, I don't think it's my bag, Bill, you know. And he said, well, you're probably not man enough to do it anyway. So that was like throwing a red flag.
That's all it took?
Yeah. So I got in and literally destroyed the car. Ran the thing until I blew the front tires off of it. Ran it till the rims cauliflowered themselves around the back in place. I had to take a torch to cut them off. Of course, we were out of the race, but I realized that it was a fun recreational thing that I was having a lot of fun doing. Of course, the equipment, I wasn't supposed to tear the equipment up.
Like no, that. I can't imagine your mechanics were too happy about that.
But anyway, I decided to do the Baja 1000. And I got about 250 miles down the course in the 1000 and tore the front end out of that. And so then Bill later had a prototype Bronco that he built. And I said, Bill, and it was a two-wheel drive. And I said, that's what I want for a race car. And he said, okay. And so we made a race car out of it, and I won the Baja 500 with it.
And this is Big Ollie?
No, this was before Big Ollie.
Oh, okay.
So once that happened, then I knew exactly what I wanted, and that's when I built Big Ollie. And I told Bill to build, try to get him to build what I wanted, and he thought, no, it was too far away from a Ford production car, and so I had Dick Russell, who worked for, was a mechanic for Straub. He said, I'll build it at home. So we started making drawings for lunch and on the car, and he built, had it just about three-quarters of the way done. Bill Straub found out about it, got mad, made us bring it up, and we finished it there. And anyway, the first year I was long gone in it, but another guy that was one of the guys I had to meet, I was about 250 miles down the course, and he went driving by while I was in the pits. And so because he had a pre-runner look just like his race car, and it was his free-runner guys. So they went down the road and pulled off, and I took off trying to catch that dust, which wasn't there. Anyway, I overdrove it and got off the road and bent the rear end house. But then I found out afterwards that he had a tremendous lead, and that was his crew that ran out there. And so anyway, I knew if the next year if I just used my head a little bit more and not drive it so hard, and I could win. But
that seems to be an ongoing theme.
Yeah, well, I wasn't the smartest race driver in the world by any means.
No, but it seems like the once you all you want to do is win, but it's a marathon and it's not a sprint, and you got to respect the car. And it seems like especially when you Parnelli Jones do that at its best, is that's when you're winning.
Well, you have to run about 90% of your capabilities. You got to back it down because there's too many things out there that can bite you. And knowing the course really plays a great part in that as well.
And now when you are moving towards the end of your career and you have two sons, Paige and PJ, growing up, could you immediately tell they had the same gene in them as you, of they wanted a race?
Well, I don't know. The first toy that gets a race car and your friends pop them up on their lap and say, you're going to be a race car driver like your father? Yeah. So they get programmed right off the bat. They were both went to mechanical things real quick. I mean, both of them learned to ride a motorcycle when they were 4 years old. So they just adopted to anything that run fast or equipment. So I bought them a couple of go-karts and, just for them to play out in the parking lots and stuff like that. Pretty soon they had a race at Ascot and they wanted to go out there race. So I procrastinated for about 3 weeks, and because every week they'd holler to go, come on, Dad, come home from work, we'll take us to the deal. It was a night race, and finally about I couldn't run out of time, and I finally had to take them.
Was there part of you, though, that didn't want to take them and didn't want them to race?
Well, I didn't want them to race, no, in the first place, because it's a dangerous sport, but anyway, I went out there, and first night, PJ won his race, and Paige crashed, but the little one. But that started the whole thing, and then it was all over then. They had to keep on doing it.
And, I unfortunately first learned about your son Paige when I saw your documentary, Godspeed, The Story of Paige Jones. And what surprised me was, is PJ and Paige, but especially Paige, was a phenom. I mean, was, you saw this young, talented driver who was going to be, I mean, it's like seeing a young Michael Jordan coming up, or a young Tiger Woods, and, you know, was robbed of that when he got, unfortunately, into an accident in sprint cars. What was sort of going through your head when that accident first happened?
Well, actually, you know, you're right. Paige was really a comer. I mean, he won 18 out of 42 races the year before, and he was, you know, in all different kinds of cars, stock cars. He ran, in open wheel cars and pavement and dirt and everything else. But when he got hurt, I thought, well, he's all right. You know, he's not that bad.
Because accidents happen. And yeah, you're in a cage, you've got a helmet.
And his accident didn't look that bad from what I'd heard about it. You know, he said he lost the front end and flipped, and the guy running the top of his car. But anyway, I called to see how he was. He was in the hospital in Ohio. And I said, and the doctor told me, I talked to the doctor, and the doctor says, I think you better get here, Joe. So Mr. Jones, and that really hit me right there. So I knew then he was hurt pretty good. So, and it's the worst day of my life.
And it's a call nobody wants to get. And
yeah.
And especially, you know, I think that's probably the transition of when you went from race car driver to race car driver back to father and son.
Yeah.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Paige received severe brain trauma and a brain injury, where most people, I would say 99% of people, maybe one wouldn't have lived after this accident, but two wouldn't have made a comeback or a rehabilitation. And this documentary that I found so moving is, it's not about a race car driver. I mean, there's racing involved, but it's one of the greatest stories of a fight for survival and a fight to come back that I've ever seen. When did you, you know, start to sort of think, you know, we're not going to, you know, I don't know how to phrase this, but there was a lot of negativity around he might not live, and then he might be, you know, Paige might be brain dead the rest of his life. Did you have the fat sort of fight in you of the race car driver of, no, he will, no, we'll help him? I mean, it seemed like your guys' determination and his determination is really what saved his life, is, no, he's not going to just be in a bed the rest of his life. He is going to lead a life again and walk again and talk again.
Well, let me tell you, they didn't think he was going to live the first 3 days. And he went through that. And the lady there, the nurse, said, I guarantee you he's not going to walk out of this hospital. I said, what do you mean? I mean, I wanted to slap her, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't want to accept that. And anyway, she was more right than I was. So we sent him from Ohio. He spent a month there. Then we sent him to California because it was the best place he could get the best treatment. And they told us we're going to have 24-hour help for the rest of his life, and all the handicap van and wheelchair and bathroom and service plate to stretch him and all that. I mean, and
his quality of life was, if he did live, was going to be terrible.
Yeah, it was going to be terrible. And Judy and I never accepted that. We just said, there's a better way. And so we just pushed and pushed. And I can remember week after week, you know, wishing that he could just get a little bit better, just a little bit better. We never accepted that he wasn't. Judy and I never, ever accepted that he was going to, this is where he's going to stop. And so we just pushed and pushed. And like I say, they give you the worst scenarios. And Paige came through it all really well.
And that's the incredible story is, it's still an ongoing battle, and this is over 20 years later. It has taken Paige to make this recovery, and I had the pleasure of meeting your son. You would never have known. I mean, if you talk to your son, you would never think, here's someone who should have been a vegetable his whole life. He is one of the happiest, effervescent people I've ever met. But, do you think it's that, do you think it was what's in him that made him such a good race car driver is also the, what gave him the fight to rehabilitate himself?
Well, you know, there's a lot of good race drivers out there. They're lacking a little bit of desire. One thing I can say about both my boys, myself, Judy as well, we don't lack any thing but desire and will to win. You know, it's that type of thing. You know, I think all of us have. In fact, we used to go on vacation, we'd all take our own car because we all wanted to win. I mean, we all, are leaders, so to speak. And, of course, we had a great friend in Rich Sloan. And Rich Sloan was filmed all of his recovery. And Paige is pretty popular. So anyway, we had all this film in the can. And that's when the movie people, like Mary, got a hold of it. We went to lunch one day, and she found out a story about Paige. And so she thought, well, we ought to do a film on this. So that's how it all came about.
And it is, like I said, it's a documentary, not just for someone who wants to see some race cars or, just anyone who wants to see a good story of will and the fight for survival and determination. You really should check out Godspeed, The Story of Paige Jones. We'll put the links up at carstories.com. And also you can go to godspeedpj.com. Now that your son is, he's happy, he's healthy, he has kids and he's married. How do you do you have a skewed view on the safety of racing now? Because unfortunately, not as bad as, when you were racing, but we're still dealing with deaths in racing, recently with Justin Wilson in IndyCar and Jules Bianchi in Formula One. Is there a part, do you have a more, personal look at it? Or do you still sort of think of this is what we're here to do? We're here to race. And unfortunately, this is a part of what we do.
Well, racing's never been totally safe.
Yeah.
That's for sure. We know racing is dangerous, although I think today's racers are a lot safer than they were in our day. You have, this course safe soft walls, on the tracks, and you have Hans device, which helps their neck and stuff like that. But the two race drivers you mentioned, Wilson and the other gentleman in Formula One, both are kind of freak accidents.
Yeah.
And, when something flies off a car and hits you in the head, it's pretty freakish, really. I don't know. We may try to make it as safe as we can, but it's certainly a lot safer today with the construction of the cars and everything than it used to be. So I don't know where we go from here, but certainly we'll do everything in our powers to make it safer as we can.
Knowing the dangers and knowing, the life, the historic life you had, the young Parnelli Jones with that T-Bucket Roadster?
Yeah.
Would you still have traded your horse for the hot rod?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have had, if it wasn't for Paige's accident, I've had a glorified career, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's the only setback I've had in life.
And even then, it's a few steps back, but it's miles forward. Because I think what you guys, the story you've been able to tell, really about how brain injuries affect so many people in the world. And, unlike cancer, or some of these diseases, head injuries need even more attention sometimes and more funding and more acknowledgement. And I think this documentary is really going to bring light to that. So it's going to help so many people in so many ways. Everybody, go to carstories.com to get the links, and you'll see the trailer for Godspeed, the story of Paige Jones, or and check out godspeedpj.com. Mr. Jones, thank you so much for letting me take up your time.
Thank you.